Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramhansa Yogananda is probably one of the most influential spiritual books of our age. Almost everyone who steps outside of what you might call the mainstream of spiritual thinking reads that book. And if you happen to be among the minority who haven't, I encourage you to do so. Because Yogananda was born to reawaken a deeper understanding of true spirituality, not religion, but spirituality. Religions are what happen afterwards. First, a great soul comes and awakens us to the divine truth within, and then over time, lesser minds grab it, and it gradually becomes a religion. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the tradition of India, this is well understood. And in the Gita, Krishna says, whenever virtue declines and misunderstanding begins to dominate, I, the Infinite Spirit, take visible form to restore the light of Dharma again. Merely turning spirituality into religion is not necessarily a sin, but it ceases to be what it started out to be. Because nothing about spirituality happens except within our own consciousness. No outer form, no building, no ritual can in itself change us. We can be changed by proper devotional understanding and participation in things that are visible to the human eye. We come together in this temple, and all of you come of your own free will. Nobody's resume is being improved. Nobody's income is being improved. And I've never promised any of you that you're more likely to get into heaven by coming here. Thank God. All of you come because something inside you says that your experience of life will be better if you spend an hour or two in this temple, weekly, daily, or every once in a while, whatever your habits might be. And we never, ever, ever want this expression of spirituality to become a religion. Even though we have put the symbol of Ananda on the wall with the other great religions of the world, because sometimes you just have to communicate as well as you can and refine the nuances later. Yogananda himself, the power and presence of the Guru, is to a very large extent the heart and soul of what self-realization is about. Not because of Yogananda himself only, but because of the principle he represents, which ironically is exactly the same principle as Christianity. The entire understanding, which is now sometimes dogmatized to the point of being annoying, is the devotion to Jesus and the power of Jesus to transform our consciousness and lift us from the ordinary into the superconscious. And that teaching is precisely and exactly true. In Autobiography of a Yogi, the first sentence, paying tribute, paying homage to India, the characteristic feature of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities, for the eternal lasting truth, rather than the superficial experience of pleasure, but eternal verities. And then Master writes, the concomitant disciple-guru relationship, which is that you cannot find eternal truth without sooner or later realizing, I need someone to take me there. And this is really not a dogma at all. This is very simple life experience. I mean, sooner or later, no matter what the field is, everyone longs to be married, to have a good friend who's going to take you through life. We go to college. We want to have a business mentor. We pick up the violin. We have to have somebody show us how to use it. And all of these are very, very minor compared to what the relationship with the Guru gives us. Because what the relationship with the Guru gives us is he introduces us to absolutely everything that the heart longs to have. I was reading the last days in Swami Kriyananda's book, The New Path, which is his autobiography, And he lived with Yogananda for the last almost 4 years of Yogananda's life. And Swami Kriyananda was present in the room on March 7th, 1952, when Yogananda breathed his last. And Swamiji starts out that chapter, and I've read it many times, and you know, one tries, Swami Kriyananda's writing is he skips along the mountaintops, and he gives you the view from the mountaintop, and then you have to figure out sort of how you climb from where you're standing up to where he's writing. And one of the ways he describes, because he starts out in that chapter, which ends with Yogananda's passing, talking about the subject of reincarnation, which is actually intimately tied to the subject of a guru, because the subject of reincarnation is about the everlasting determination of the individual soul to find perfect freedom and perfect bliss. It's self-evident that in the course, in the space of time between birth and death in one incarnation, we can learn a certain amount, but many times people reach the end of their lives, as my friend Davy's mother said when she was in the hospital. She was a very sweet, childlike woman, and she died in that hospital bed. And she said to her daughter, "I always thought that when I would get older, I would get wiser, but I didn't." We may get wiser in the sense of more cynical. You know, yeah, that's what life is like. You know, older and wiser is kind of a cynical mockery of the soul's true expansive understanding. But we really do want to get wiser as we get older, don't we? And wiser not just in the ways of the world, but wiser according to the values that we know we are really seeking. And those values are perfect freedom and perfect joy. Isn't that so? And Swamiji describes in that chapter this paradox that we all live with, which is from the very beginning of our babyhood, we reach out to the things around us out of a longing from our heart for a fulfillment and satisfaction. I was with a friend when his daughter was born. Minutes after that daughter was born, she had reached up her hand and grasped the fingers of her father. And of course, the father, you know, falling in love with his baby as parents do, reached out immediately, and his heart was just melted by those tiny fingers grabbing his. Why does a baby reach out immediately? Because it sees something that it thinks is going to give it pleasure, and it reaches for it. And the irony of this world is that all we ever enjoy is our own inner experience. We never cease to be ourselves and actually become the finger of our father that we're grasping, but we feel it inside ourselves, and there begins right from the start this association. I reach, I touch, I experience, I taste, I feel good, therefore that is causing this. And of course what happens is that world out there is very, very difficult to control. That charming little baby grows up, becomes a sassy teenager, you know, goes on the trajectory of its own life, and whereas mother and father used to be the center of its world, now every once in a while the little girl will call, you know, because we can't simply make it do what we want. And meanwhile, we always remain the same as we are, and we think that what's reflecting back to us our own potential for joy is actually the source of that joy. And as Swamiji says, the only interest we have in ourselves at the beginning of our soul's gradual journey back to God is to try to adjust ourselves sufficiently so that the reflection will be better. Maybe if I change my hair color, maybe if I lose a few pounds, maybe if I get this expensive handmade suit, maybe if I drive this really fancy car, then some way or another, if I shift that myself in that little way, then the reflection will also be more warm to me. But over the course of many lifetimes, and it does take many lifetimes, there is what Yogananda says in the Autobiography of a Yogi, a certain anguishing monotony to the process. Two of my favorite words in that book. they're sort of oxymoronic when you think about it, monotony and anguish. They don't exactly go together, but there's something so exquisite about anguishing monotony, which is, oh my gosh, here we are again. Here we are again, you know, maybe at the end of our lives and realizing I got old again without getting wise. And that finally, at some point, a desperate longing begins to set in. And it's not merely, oh, wouldn't it be nice? The kind of, oh, wouldn't it be nice? I'll be spiritual for a while until I have enough money to go to Europe, you know. As Sri Ramakrishna once said, when a man came after he lost his money and he lost his wife because he lost his money, and he came to Ramakrishna and says, I want to be a renunciate. I want to renounce the world. And Ramakrishna said, you have not renounced the world. The world has renounced you. So when the world renounces us, then all of a sudden it occurs to us that maybe I'll be a renunciate. Maybe I'll just think about God. But then the world creeps back in. And all of a sudden we have that confusion. Where is my happiness coming from? And to make a very long story shorter, eventually we begin to see that the one consistent factor is my own consciousness. And suddenly we realize that it isn't a matter of just adjusting that world out there. The entire matter is adjusting my inner reality in relation to it. And we are constantly served in that effort by what we call in the festival God's awakened sons. Those souls who have been through the same process we've been through, hard to imagine when you think about what Jesus Christ could do, that at one point he was just like us. That's the missing link in Christianity as it's taught right now, is that this is a self-realized master. And we too will be self-realized masters when we simply finish the journey that we are presently on. And these masters descend for one reason, to say, okay, put your foot there, put your thought here, put your hand here, put your heart in this direction. The self-realized master is one who has completed the journey, has found perfect freedom, experiences nothing but bliss, but out of compassion for all of us, comes back to show us the way. And on that level, the way in which the masters help us is more subtle than just drawing a map. Because what we're really trying to shift is our fundamental vibration. And our vibration is our consciousness, which leads to our thoughts, which leads to all our actions. And vibration is shifted by many subtle ways, including simply the influence of the right vibration. Our choir just sang that beautiful arrangement of that beautiful song to Master. And that arrangement is so pretty because you can hear all the different voices playing together, can't you? And one of the ways they sing so well is they listen to each other. And everybody listens to each other and they find the right notes. And you could see as they sang together through the song more and more, you could just feel the choir coming into attunement with itself, into attunement with the song, and into attunement with the consciousness behind it. So the long process of our self-realization, of one lifetime, of one day, of one meditation, is just sort of starting out somewhere close to it. And then by sensitive living, listening, by sensitive self-expression, by cooperative effort, and above all, by the grace of God coming through. In that particular song, you keep coming back to the chorus, there is no other love like the Master's love for me. It's very hard not to keep singing that over and over without beginning to think about what that means. And they just demonstrated in the singing of it the extraordinarily beautiful possibility of it. And so the masters exist, you know, for us, and they live for one reason and one reason only. They come and they make this huge demonstration of their personalities, and they set up, as Master did, books and teachings and places and all those things. But then the day comes when that physical body is finished. Master was in his 60th year, as they counted in India, 59 years old. His 60th year, which is spiritually and astrologically a very auspicious time. And he finished his work. And he finished his work so dramatically in a big public place. He recited a poem about India. He spoke about the work and harmony between India and America. And then he stopped his heart, because his life was always completely under his control. And the actual literal moment came when that incarnation had ended. Jesus was crucified. He hung on the cross. Usually took a very long time for someone to die by that method. But Jesus went through and did everything he needed to do from the cross, you know, giving care of his mother to John, forgiving those who tortured him, speaking of to those who were next to him, "I will meet you in paradise." And then he said, "It is finished." And then he just gave up the spirit. Also very dramatic. You know, it is finished. Master is done. He's done for that incarnation, that name, that form. But he's not done with us. Because, alas, we are not finished. But as he writes in that beautiful letter to the sister, I love this part. "I don't mind your difficulties. I don't mind your problems. I don't mind." Listen to those words. "I don't mind. Everybody has something they have to get through. And everybody, something is different." And then Master says in that letter, "I will never give up my job with you." Think about that. Don't just think about that. Think about that all the time. Never let go of that thought. Never let go of that thought. Master is there. He will never give up his job with us. And how do we become the recipient of that promise? By receiving him. That's how they put it in the Bible. To all those who received him. And any self-realized master, the same rules apply. All that we have to do is receive him. All that we have to do is have courage. All that we have to do is persevere. And then Master, the question is asked, Swami Kriyananda asked Master, "When you are gone physically from this body," is the implication, "will you be as close to us then as you are now?" Master replied, "To those who think me near, I will be near." You know, life exists on many, many levels simultaneously. The vibrations of superconsciousness are ever present. God is as much present in any moment as he will ever be. It is a question of what we attune ourselves to. That's what we experience. So when Swamiji asks, "Master, will you be there?" Master replies, "If you think me near." And that wasn't just a matter of faith. What he also meant is, if you align your consciousness with mine, you will discover that I am the same. That's why Jesus said in the Bible, "Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them." That also means, Master said, two or more of your own thoughts gathered together. But Jesus didn't say, "I will be." He said, "I am." Master didn't say, "I will come." Master only said, "If you attune yourself to me, you will find that I am there. Because I will never give up my job about you." When I came into the temple this morning, I had a very cheerful aura about me. And someone remarked, "You look very happy this morning." I said, all the way from the community to here today, all I could think about is, oh, what luck to have a guru. You know, what good karma even to hear about the possibility of an eternal friend that death cannot separate from us, who will never give up his job about us, and that job is to make us free. What joy. And the mere fact that Master has physically left this world, Masters live for very short periods of time, and they only come every once in a while. We have many, many, many incarnations when we're not physically with the divine soul, whoever he might be, who's guiding us. You would have to, when you think about it, because they only come sometimes and we come over and over again. But time and space is no obstacle. To those who think me near, I will be near. To all who received him, to them gave he the power to become self-realized as he is. It's really simply up to us. Bless you.